Good morning, everyone, to this last day of the IGF marathon. Some of you look pretty tired. We really appreciate that you made it, got out of the bed, and are interested enough to listen to this workshop's presentations. This best practice forum, one size didn't fit all. What can be learned from the diversity of existing CCTLD management examples? The goal of this workshop is to display the local diversity of CCTLD management models that can be found in the CCTLD namespace, and to demonstrate that there is not one model that is best and would work everywhere. CCTLD models need to reflect local conditions. But what are local needs and how do they translate into management models? We would like to focus on two specific aspects, one of which is the business model of the various registries, and the second one is concerns the relationship between CCTLD management and the government. We have invited five speakers, actually six, one couldn't make it, who will present five different models. We start with .ZA, South Africa. To my right is Vika Mpizane, who will be first and who also has to leave earlier than the others. So if you have questions, you can raise them directly after the presentations. We will then get a presentation from Nikati, the registry from Austria, and we get presentations from Richard Wein, Wein, who is the general manager, and from Christian Singer, who works for the Federal Ministry of Transport, Innovation and Technology and is also the Austrian GAC member. Then we get a presentation from GPRS. This is a .JP, Hiro Hotta, who is the director of that registry. Number four will be .EU, Mark van Wesemaal, who is general manager of URID. And then we get a presentation from the LACTIER, about the LACTLD. This is Margarita Valdes, who sits to my left. She's the general counsel of NIC Chile. She will talk about Chile and not about the whole LAC area. So we start with South Africa, and we hope to discuss afterwards the various strengths, but perhaps also weaknesses or challenges which the respective registries face at the moment. So please, you have the floor, Vika. Yeah, you can use that one.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Vika Mpisane. I'm the general manager of the South Africa's TLD institution, .ZA, Domain Name Authority. That's our logo there at the top right-hand corner. That looks something like a bit Rastafarian, but we are fine. I'll talk about just within the next 8 or 9 minutes, a couple of things. That's my agenda there, brief background to .ZA, and then a history of how it came about, the way forward, I mean the current situation and then the way forward. A brief history is that .ZA, Domain Name Authority, is a statutory institution established in terms of the ECT Act, that stands for Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, 25 of 2002, and we're a non-profit organization. I think that's probably the model that is popular throughout CCTLDs in the world. Our key activities or key terms of reference in terms of that legislation is that we administer and manage the .ZA domain space. We license registries and registrars, and in doing that, obviously, we observe the global best practices, what's happening at ICANN level, what's happening in other regions. And then we also come up with various procedures and regulations Another important aspect also is that we have to educate our society, various sectors of the society, the business, in particular small business, and then the youth, women, and various other sectors of society, to make them aware of the domain name system, its role in global presence, and then also its role in economic development. We are also required to facilitate the dispute resolution process for the .za domain name space, and then make policy recommendations, policy recommendations, not only within the domain name space, but also within internet development and governments as a whole. We have a 9-member board. Currently, we have a new board that met on Tuesday, and the interesting thing that I missed that meeting. But the board needed to meet, and we needed to orientate the new board members on the domain name system. I'm the one who's heading the daily operations of .za for the past 1.5 years now. The history is that the origin of the .za DNS was that it was run by individuals, started as an academic project that certain people initiated in South Africa. And obviously then from that project were born out a couple, the model of .za, then a couple of domains under .za. The policy and structure in itself, obviously this being run by people as an academic project, it was fairly ad hoc. But they adopted a second-level domain structure, which I'm going to explain. As a result of that, though, there were many domains that were allowed, or as it were, or introduced within the space, and then started to have overcrowding. We had open domains, we had closed domains, we had private domains. And the standards among these SLDs were different, too. That's the current crisis we're facing, but we are working on policy and licensing requirements to sort that out. There was also a lack of legislative compliance. If you're in South Africa, you probably will know about what we call black economic empowerment due to our history. Within this particular sector, there was no plan, there was no program, there was no vision of complying with that aspect of our policy direction in South Africa. And then as a result, government intervened, and then there was a redelegation of .za that took place in January 2005. There were obviously almost 2 or 3 years of discussions going back and forth between government and the people who had introduced .za. Ultimately, they agreed to set up an independent institution that government would fund, but it would be a membership-based institution, and that is ourselves, .za. All right, so the obviously I've covered just the delegation there and a bit of that of what was happening, that it was an academic project. So I'll just jump that space. Probably the last two bullet points just point out that the organizations that were involved in any case in the development of .za before this authority was established was ISOC, the ISOC chapter in South Africa, and an organization that had been set up called Namespace ZA. And then an overview of the current situation, when I spoke about second-level domain overcrowding, you'll probably see there that you have active subdomains, the ones that are working, the ones that are registering domain names. You have ac.za, which is closed, is for academic institutions and research institutions, CET and others that are still active. The main player within our space is co.za. People who attend ICANN and AFRINIC meetings obviously would know that. It's co.za who have made it a business over the past few years, and they are standing at almost close to 400,000 domain names, just them on their own. And the next one that follows them by far margin is org.za, obviously because it's targeting non-profit organizations, and it's only almost around 15,000 domain names, and the rest is everybody standing at 1,000 and something, and others are standing at 100 and something. So that's the current scenario we're facing. We have domain subdomains that were introduced. They are no longer functional now, and the authority will have to close those down or review if there's a need for them. And then we have private subdomains, again, where we are even struggling. We have struggled over the past year to get hold of the administrators and stuff to know who was running with it, but it seems also that most of them are as dormant as we would assume. The ones, obviously, that I've put stars next to is just to explain that there are those that are no longer accepting registrations and those that are apparently no longer in use. We've put a moratorium on new registrations on all other .za domains except the active ones that I had on the slide before this one is active. We've put a moratorium, obviously, because we don't think that they are needed in space, or we need, there's something that really must drastically change. I've spoken of about CO.ZA being the most dominant one. Another scenario that we have is that we have some registries still acting as registrars, but for the small, obviously, for the small closed domains. You know, a person will run that domain, and again, if you want to register, you'll go to them. They're not open to other registrars. And then, obviously, there are greater differences in technical and operational standards. But we have willingness by administrators of these domains to have most of these SLDs closed or given, handed over to the authority. And also, we've seen also a poor marketing and sales and poor marketing and sales efforts. Sorry, my repetition there. The way forward is that we're working on a policy that we're probably around 60-70% towards completion now. We're reviewing the whole space. We have participation by most of the industry players, in any case, commenting to our policy. We are supposed to table early next year a final policy. We are basically consolidating the second level domain structure. So we will not be going the route of .de, for example, I think, and .no, where you register viga.no, viga.fr. We'll still keep it at viga.co.za, viga.org.za, because we think if it's not broken, there isn't really need to fix it. The major change is that we are introducing a single commercial operator to run these registries, all of them. We initially thought you wouldn't include closed ones, but it looks like people are willing to hand this over to one entity that will run all these the second-level domains. Obviously, we are separating the registrar roles. A registrar operator should not be a registrar, you know, and the competition will only be at the registrar level. And we are setting up a licensing regime that defines the technical standards and regulations, and we are working on that, and we hope by March we will have come up with a licensing regime and we'll be able to take in license applications. And we are obviously outlining our registration procedures and making them standardized across. And we are working on pricing, too, to make it affordable. Well, we're working also on education and awareness. We are mobilizing stakeholders. We have in our industry a dilemma, again, of only a few that are participating, yet the impact to the rest of the country. And we're trying to get business in there. We are trying to get civil society in there, the youth and other people to participate. We are working on communication and marketing. After all, the domain name system does become a competitive environment. If other CCTLDs are standing at around 11 million and we're standing at less than 500,000, obviously we still have a lot of ground to catch up with. We are also looking at strategic partnerships with various organizations back home, one of them being the Companies and Intellectual Property Registration Office, where companies register their names, and we need to come to some form of partnership with them so that whoever registers a company may have an option straight away also of registering a domain name. I don't think we'll subsidize that registration, but we're making people aware of the importance of it. We introduced early this year the dispute resolution process for the co.za domain name space, obviously because it's the most dominant and it's for commercial entities primarily. And there was fighting over a couple of names, and as you will know, the court process will take almost 2 years to three, and at South African rand, you'll spend around about 150,000 rands to 200,000 rands. And we've come up now with the DRP, and to have your domain name dispute resolved, you pay only 10,000 rands. The authority accredits the entities that resolve these disputes, and we monitor and evaluate what they do. We also publish on our website the decisions that have been made. We haven't had too many, but we are heading close to 10 now. And then also we offer financial assistance to those people who would like to lodge disputes, but they think they cannot resolve they cannot pay afford the fees. But we have, again, an eligibility criteria that's fairly strict on who qualifies for that assistance. I thank you.
Thank you, Vika. Are there questions or comments? Please, Emily.
Thank you very much for your interesting presentation, Vika. I also wanted to compliment you on the initiative of the domain name workshops that you held recently that we were involved in on dispute resolution. The feedback that we had from our people who attended was that it was an extremely worthwhile session, and that it helped to spread the knowledge and to collaborate as well. And so we were very pleased to take part in that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Emily.
More questions? Then I would have one. Oh, Sabine.
I have one question. You said you don't want to go do the registration on the second level because if things aren't broken, why fix it? But let's say when you say on the other hand side you're heading for one single operator for on the second level, domains as a registry, there might be an opportunity to open up the first level. And from when you say a marketing perspective, my expect is that you get actually much more registration because people think it's more attractive to register on the first level. So the question is, is that a decision you have taken now finally, or is it open for discussion if there is a need?
That's an interesting question. To be honest, I wouldn't say it's as final as it will be standing in the next 10 years. Probably it's been more of trying to, let's first consolidate what we have, and then we can review. I do foresee maybe a review in 4 or 5 years' time, because there was a strong push. In fact, I remember last year, around about this time, when we went to ICANN Sao Paulo, the board was fairly divided, because there were those who supported what is called a hybrid model, where you also open, you allow CO.ZA and others to run. But then you allow people also, if they want, to register straight up, peter.za, viga.za. And we went through a process of speaking to both sides. We spoke to guys from Norway, we spoke to guys from France, we spoke to guys from Brazil. On the other side, we spoke also to guys from UK, Nominate, we spoke to Australia, Christie Spain, and others. And I was required to make a recommendation. At the end of the day, when I got to my board, I thought there wasn't at this present moment a strong enough or a better business case to justify the radical change. But also the constraint that once you move for registrations at the second level, you, as far as I know, cannot reverse and change in the future and say, it's not working for me, I'm going back to CO.ZA,
I was going to ask you about models, but now you have answered that question partly by spelling out all the registries you've talked to. But a second question would concern how do you make these decisions and what role does the government play in this restructuration process?
The role that government through the Department of Communications play is fairly minimal, to be honest. It's fairly minimal. It's been to provide funds for the authority to be set up, and we are still receiving our funds from the government. Probably the next financial year being the last one, because then we'll start taking license fees. We'll start charging, getting our fees on domain name registrations. So that's basically the role that government plays in terms of the legislation. When we make these regulations, we are supposed to go to the minister and table them. And say this is the direction that we are that we will be taking. She typically wouldn't be a person that would oppose that. The attitude that government has is that they've set up this authority to give direction. So the role of government is really minimal, and we are more self-regulating as the industry. Being a membership-based organization, we tend to hear more from the registrars and the registries where we should be going. And then we go back to government and say this is the direction. And an example is that early this year, when we took a decision of having a single operator running the domains, we went to the minister because she needed to report to parliament in her budget vote speech. And she did go out and said that the authority has recommended this route, and I endorse it.
Okay, thank you, Vika. Perhaps we now follow with Austria. Richard Wein and Christian Singer.
Thank you for coming.
Willst du das oder das nutzen? Das vom, welches Mikro willst du nutzen?
So, good morning from my side. What's my agenda? What's our agenda? I would like to give you some short information about the history and the current structure, some basic information about NIC-AT and AT, and a short idea about our project NetID, which means what is the use of our surplus from the registry. And then I want to hand over to our GAC, Mr. Singer. AT was registered in 1988 by the University of Vienna. At that time, there was just an email from the professor at Vienna to John Postel and said, hey, please put it on the route, and that happened. At that time, it was only possible to register AT domains with a second category, which AC for academic, GVV for government, CO for commercial and or for organization, and the registry was operated nearly 10 years by the University of Vienna. After some more importance and some growing, the Vienna University decided, oh, maybe it's not a good idea to have only a flat registration, to have no flat registration, and so they decided to change the policy completely. And that after that time, it was possible to register IT flat. That means no categories in there. And the really new thing was domains are built at that time. Before, it was free. After that idea, the university said, oh, that's not our business. We should have a real registry. And NIC-AT was founded in 1998 as a, in German, GmbH. It's a limited private company. Our first owner was the ISP association in Austria called ISPA. And this association established or founded the Internet Privatstiftung Austria, which is a non-profit private foundation. That's our current owner now, and since 2002. Just a few words about IT. We have around 750,000 domain names now. We have about 25 people staff. We have two sales models, let's say. We have a direct customer and also a registrar model. We have around 480 registrars around the world on the current status. We have no restrictions. That means everybody in the world could register AT domains, even they are paid. And it's a historical reason. The university runs our DNS and our database under a special contract. That's maybe interesting for some. NIC-AT, the registry, is for profit. But, and the other but, all the surplus goes to the beneficial private foundation. And at the foundation, a special council decides what will happen with the money, what's going on there. I will explain with a short words what is the structure of the IPA and what is the function of there. We have on the foundation council. This council is responsible to elect and to select every other members from other boards or other councils. And they are also responsible for strategic decisions and basic financial decisions. For example, to set up a new company, which we did with the Enum company, which is also a sister, let's say, of NIC-AT. The board of directors are the responsible person for the more or less day-to-day business with NIC-AT, with me or with my colleague from the company. The Domain Names Council is our policy council, which is responsible for decisions for policy. Christian Singer will that explain later on. And the sponsorship council is responsible to decide what happens with our surplus, what happens with our money. The legal situation in Austria is that a foundation has not an owner, it's only a purpose. And the purpose is very simple, it's to promote the internet in Austria. And there are some specific points in this charter. Here in detail it's to act as a trustee to administrate the IT domain space for the benefit of the general public. And private bottom-up self-administration of CCCTLD, IT, in a transparent and effective manner. And BIPA is the representative of the local internet community. Just a few words about the project Net idea and what's going on with the money. In the past, we have a lot of rumors what happens with the money from Nick IT. And after some discussions with our local internet community, we decided to set up a project called Net idea, which is a call that we or a time slot give every year to the public and say, please send in applications, new idea, and we will sponsor it. This special sponsorship council then will decide, okay, who will receive the money and what amount will receive this application. For example, we spent in 2006 nearly a little bit more than half a million euro, and in 2007 nearly half a million euro. And we will do that every year. There are only two or three conditions for the applicants. The one thing is the result must be public, public available, open source. So that is a really a benefit for the local internet community for the public in Austria. That's it. We have two permanent beneficiaries. It's university, and one it's ISPA. They will receive a yearly fixed amount of money to run their research work at the university and to run the business for the ISP Association. That's from my side, and now we'll hand over to.
Okay, thank you, Richard. And now from the government perspective, Herr Singer.
Good morning, everybody. Yeah. The government has something to say in the DNS process, of course. The special situation of the IT zone in Austria is that it's not subject of the national numbering plan. Why did it happen so? Well, there is one story. I don't know tell you if it's true or not, but people who know me know that I'm a lazy person. And some morning I woke up and asked myself, Christian, do you really, really want to organize, to administer, to supervise, and to regulate the DNS system? And, well, the answer was quite simple, no, I never would do that. So what to do? I started to talk to my minister and proposed to amend the Austrian Telecoms Act and to exclude the DNS system from the national numbering plan, and thanks God I was successful. The national numbering plans, you know, are the telephone numbers you use when you use your fixed or mobile telephone network. And it's quite a formal process to allocate these numbers. And so it's quite clear that I was really, really happy that it was excluded from the numbering plans and given to private hands. So domain names are not covered by any regulatory activities, and surprise, surprise, it really does work. So it's totally administered by the private sector, by Nick AT, which Richard explained to you. How could we explain that? What's the reason for that? What's the really reason? Well, we say the internet is owned by private entities. Excuse me if it's not really accurate, but that's the simple explanation. ISPs provide access, telcos provide infrastructure and the local internet community provides users and everything else that is necessary that the internet really works. And the DNS system was developed by the universities in a quite private and in the beginning in a quite hidden environment. And that's the main difference to the national telephony. National telephony was developed by the states within the framework of an international organization, within the framework of the ITU. And if you want to change an international prefix for the telephony, you have to go to ITU and have to undergo a process of international consultation. It's quite complicated. And thanks God it's not the way in means of a DNS, though I understand it's not that easy anymore, but it's much easier than it would have been if it was the same system of the numbering plan. And well, since the internet is provided, the infrastructure and the service is provided privately, then it's the logical consequence that the management of domain names is privately provided too. But one might ask, why is it NIC-AT? Well, NIC-AT was provided without any governmental interference. And governmental interference was not necessary since it perfectly worked. And, well, of course, there is only one registry possible. It's the Highlander effect, as I call it. There is only one possible. So it's clear you only can have one registry for each ccTLD, and there is no competition possible. How would that work? Somebody must be the boss. Somebody must organize the primary directory. So it's clear only it could be one registry, and NIC-AT was here, and they do the job quite well. And since the management of the internet is organized privately, then it's clear that DNS should only be organized privately too. What's the governmental view? Well, I said I'm a lazy person, so never touch a running system. Why should I change anything? Why should the government change anything? So someday the government realized, oh my God, there is something like the internet. We didn't use that before, but now we realize we are using it heavily. We are heavily dependent on that. But thanks God, it works. Thanks God, there is somebody who takes care of the internet. Thanks God, there is the local internet community who looks after the internet and provides a stable service. So we had no reason to interfere, and we restricted our activity to some sort of supervision, some sort of coordination, some sort of discussion, and, well, the instrument of discussing that is the Domain Name Council. I will explain to you in the next slide. And since we have huge support from the local internet community for that model, and since via the mean of NetID, NIC-AT serves the public interests, we also don't see to change anything. Well, the Domain Name Council is the advisory board, is the talking platform where we get the information from NIC-AT and where we try to influence the policy of NIC-AT. It consists of registrars, of lawyers, of international experts. So the local internet community is well represented within the Domain Name Council. And we give advice. We developed an arbitration procedure. We helped develop the general policy. The introduction of IDN was broadly discussed within the Domain Name Council. So, summary. I've got 30 seconds. Fact one, no legislation is possible. Fact two, we have a very excellent relationship between NIC-AT and the government. It's a private bottom-up self-administration and the broad support from the local internet community. NetID serves public interests, and all stakeholders are happy. So last point, why should we change anything? The answer is no, there is no reason for that. So I hope I was on time. Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to your questions afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you, Christian Singer. I would now like to ask Hiro Hotta to present .jp.
Thank you. Where's mine? Should open this.
Do you want to have a look, Pete?
JP2. I think this is the one.
Yeah.
Yes. Good morning. My name is Hiro Hotta from JPRS, the .jp CCTLD. Let me give you a brief introduction on the .jp governance. Okay, this is the history of .jp management. In 1986, it's around 21 years ago, .jp was delegated to an individual who was a university professor, Jun Murai. And in 1993, JPNIC, Japan Network Information Center, was established as a government-approved, membership-based, non-profit organization. And Jun Murai was the president of that and started managing .jp. In 2000, many of you remember that the in around 2000 there was an dot-com boom, and .jp was in Japanese market. .jp was in competition with dot-com, and the JPNIC thought about the privatization of .jp management because the this kind of government-approved not-for-profit organization has less flexibility in doing business, such as they cannot borrow money from somewhere. So it's a Japanese regulation. So it was not easy to invest their on their system forward. So JPNIC thought about that, and its General Assembly resolved the establishment of a new company as a private for-profit company. That was us, the JPRS. And in 2002, January, the government endorsed us as manager for the JPTLD. And we agreed with JPNIC for a transfer of the JP management formally. And in February 2002, CCTLD sponsorship agreement for the JP with the ICANN was executed. This means that we are one of the very few CCTLD organizations, managers, who agrees with ICANN in a formal contract form. And in April that year, the transfer of .jp management's responsibility and operation from JPNIC to JPRS completed. This means that the re-delegation is completed. It was a long way to make this re-delegation. Maybe it took around 1.5 years. And this is a framework of .jp management and administration. It's a little bit complex. This is me, JPRS. And we have sponsorship agreement with ICANN. JPNIC, which is a former manager of .jp, oversees us. I'm sorry. It's going. Oversees us with through consultation with the government. Oversee means that they are checking constantly that whether JPRS is doing a good management on .jp. So this is the contract with JPNIC, between JPNIC and JPRS. So government is, as you see, the government is one step away through the JPNIC from us. So we don't have a direct relationship with the government. This means that we don't have contractual relationship with the government. And also, there is no regulation law on the internet, about the internet in Japan. So we are not regulated by the government as a domain name manager. Of course, we are a private sector company, so there's a usual law governing us, but no law for the internet or domain name.
And JPNIC is a public, private?
Yes, and the JPNIC is a semi-public, semi-private organization, which is membership-based, and which is approved by the government. So JPNIC can have has members from the business sector, usually business sector like ISPs or hosting providers, and some vendors. So anybody can join JPNIC. So through JPNIC, the communication can oversee us. This is a mechanism how a community in Japan can oversee us. So we have advisory committee, which is for the .jp, I'm sorry, for .jp policy. And of course, many people, at this moment, I think six people from the community joins the advisory committee, like business sector, academy, ISPs, registrars, and something. And of course, consumers. But there's no government representative in our advisory committee. And we have communication with the community through annual report, website, and something. And of course, we meet with our DNS managers, meeting with registrars, and we do education activities to the community. This is how the management of .jp works. As you see, the .jp governance, we have no contractual relationships with the government, no specific governing law for the internet operation, as I said, and government supports private sector-driven internet governance. This is their basic attitude. And oversight of .jp management, it's under the contract between JPRS and JPNIC. JPNIC oversees the .jp management with reporting or consulting with the government. And JPNIC is a not-for-profit community-based membership organization, which anybody can join. An autonomous effort in .jp management. Of course, we have to, we should serve for the community. So we do some autonomous effort, even if there's no governing law or a contract. So openness and transparency. We have advisory committee. We have annual registry report issued. And of course, we release press releases and announces about major activities. And high service quality, security and stability, of course, and spontaneous observation of telecommunication business guidelines set by government and the industry group. There's some telecommunication business guidelines which is applied for usually the telephone operators, but we spontaneously or autonomously observe the guidelines. And we do registry data escrow in case we fail. And community service. We lead projects for healthy use of domain names and DNS. And we educate of DNS, internet, through conferences, websites, mailing lists, We operate one of the root servers, which is M root server. Advisory committee. Maybe I have already explained this. And it's open and transparent. Observers welcome, and documents and detailed minutes posted on website. This is the last slide. Summary. .jp CCTLT Manager, JPRS, is a private for-profit company with no contractual relationship with the government. But the government endorses the activities of JPRS by publicizing an endorsement letter and keeps endorsing us through observation of the activities of us. And JPRS serves the interest of the internet community through autonomous effort in accord with the basic policy principles of the Japanese government. So private sector-driven internet governance, that's one sentence of the .jp management. Thank you.
Thank you, Hiro. We now get a presentation from one of the more recent registries, URIT for .eu. Mark?
With pleasure.
I think you need to get out of here, probably. And then
yes.
Get out, yeah.
This one?
Yeah. Twice.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. My name is Mark van Wezemaal. I have four slides. So it will be a short introduction to what the .eu is as a and in what it differs from the rest of my colleagues around the table. To start the discussion, I would like to give you a little introduction in the timeline of how .eu came into being. It was an initiative started by the European Commission in 1999, was taken up in the Europe initiative in March 2000. In 2002, there was a regulation that defined that there should be a .eu top-level domain. Next, there came a request for expression of interests where the candidates to run that .eu could enter their files, their applications, and URIT was chosen in 2003. It is a 5-year contract that is renewable for the same period. Afterwards, there was a regulation, again in 2004, that laid down the public policy rules concerning the implementation and functioning of the .eu, which means the rules to register a domain name, who can register a domain name, and what should the domain name look like. The registry started operations on 7th of December 2005 with the sunrise and opened registrations for everybody on April the 7th. I'll come back to this. This is the timeline. The content, I would like to build up the contractual relationship that URIT has with the European Commission in this slide. First of all, this, as expanded in the previous slide, we had the regulation in 2002 that said already that the registry should be a non-profit organization, that it should have the registrar model with no direct registrations, and with a contract with registrars, that a public policy must be created by the European Commission assisted by the COCOM, the Communication Committee, and it should only be for residents of the European Union. There was also to be an exception list with geographical and geopolitical names, and provisions for a phased registration should be provided, which is the famous sunrise, which allowed users of certain rights to register their names up front. And lastly, there had to be an ADR alternative dispute resolution procedure. This was laid down in the first regulation in 2002 before any candidate was chosen or before even any application was sent in. As it was said in the timeline, after the manager was chosen, in this case Jurid, the second regulation was put together by the EC, by the European Commission, and the member states in consultation with the chosen manager of the TLD. It defines the principles, who can register a name, who are the registrars, who can be a registrar, what should the phased registrations look like, what is the alternative dispute resolution, which are the reserved and blocked names, what about bona vacantia, which is when a name becomes available because the owner dies, for instance, and registration procedures that is a first-come, first-served principle. Then Jurid and the Commission concluded a concession contract, and this makes the framework, the legal framework within which Jurid can work. In that work, it is supervised by the European Commission, so to see whether Jurid is doing its work within that legal framework. But on the other hand, the European Commission is also supervised, and I'm not a specialist in European structures, but it's supervised by the European Parliament and the Council of European Union, which in their function are elected by the European citizens and the stakeholders in Europe. So indirectly, we have the whole citizenship of Europe taking part in what has become the manager of the .eu TLD. On the other hand, Jurid has a strategic committee that advises the board on matters as policy that, of course, are limited within the framework of the legal regulations. This strategic committee consists of stakeholders and are currently ISOC, the Business Europe, which is the federation of federations of companies, and the members of Jurid, which are the five registries from Belgium, Sweden, Italy, Slovenia, and the Czech Republic. And it's open for other stakeholder groups. So this is basically the model that Jurid works in. We think that that model is quite successful because we had a successful sunrise, a model that has on which the new .asia has based their own sunrise model. The land rush was on 7 April 2006 very successful, with 3 million transactions in the course of about 12 hours. More than 1 million new domain names registered in the first day, and with a maximum of transactions per minute, 8,416, or that is, on average, during that minute, 140 transactions per second. So it was quite a heavy load and a big interest from the market. The model is showing sustained growth and growing use of the .eu. More than 2.6 million names are registered for the moment, and the .eu is currently number 8 in the world. There is a continued interest with more than 2,800 now, even going up to 3,000 new registrations a day. And the Europeans have started to perceive the added value of .eu. And that we can see by the growing numbers of DNS queries on our name servers. about 82% of the domain names resolve to a real email address or a website, which is quite high in usage terms. And we see a growing number of .eus in the streets, in the advertising, either in little advertising or in big ones. So, to conclude my presentation, it is a successful model with a working dispute resolution procedure, registrars in more than 40 countries, full service in all and support in all official European languages, and a code of conduct that has been implemented and which is based on self-regulations by the registrars. And one comment is that we seem to have a quite rigid legal framework with these regulations and contract, but we consider that as having a stabilizing effect on our business, because we don't have these continued discussions about things that should change, because people know that we are bound by the regulations. There might be a potential danger that the rigid framework, legal framework, affects flexibility, because if things would have to change, we might have to change the regulations. But the model has been made such that it leaves a lot of room for further initiative and development, and has not been limiting up till now, according to our experience. Well, that's my introduction.
Thank you, Mark. I'm sure the audience would like to know more about how this complex regulation affects your everyday work. But before we discuss these things, we get our last presentation from Margarita Valdez about .cl.
Hello, my name is Margarita Valdez. I'm from Chile. I'm from the registry for .cl, that is a country code in Chile. Sorry. And I will show you the experience of operating .cl inside the university. This is in .cl was delegated to the Department of Computer Science of the University of Chile in 1987. We operate without formal registration in that days, any agreement, and without fees for 10 years. About 1,000 registered domain names in 1997 we had. That was the day that we had a formalization in September. Rules that we introduced in 1997. And in formal times, people just ask us, I want to use this kind of domain name, and we put it in a list. But after 1997, we asked a proper identification of the registrants. There was an until now registration fees, re-registration for all pre-existing domain names. We installed the dispute resolution policy based on arbitration, and it's a very interesting point, because it was 2 years before the uniform and dispute resolution policy it was working. And our local dispute resolution policy later extended to include mediation before arbitration. Why is .cl so popular? Few restrictions on who can register and what can be registered. Minimal bureaucracy at time of registration. The conflicts handled through dispute resolution policy. It's a proper local dispute resolution policy. The registration at second, it's at second level. It's just under .cl. So the address, the domain names are short and easy to work with that. The work is hard to offer good quality of service, good customer support, diversity in means of payment, free services like mediation, secondary DNS services, and low registration fees. how we are we have involvement with the community. In October 2000, an advisory board was created to discuss and make recommendations about the policy for registrations under .cl. The board included a variety of members of the community and two undersecretaries from the government, telecommunications and economy. Several policies changes were made on the advice of this board. The advisory board ceased operating in September 2003. In its final meeting, we approved the recommendation that .cl should join the CSNSO. We also agreed to run IDN in 2007 in the next step that we will see. Right, no, sorry, 2005, I'm sorry. We are organizing with the government an early response net involving ISPs, with NIC Chile, universities, and governmental entities. After this advisory board, we got the National Council of Domain Names and IP Addresses. It was created in June 2003 by decree of the Ministry of Telecommunications, met for the first time on April 2004. The mission of this council is to provide recommendations about policy. The members are representatives of the community, industry, business, IPs, ISPs, academics, and etc. And government, telecommunications and economy, and NIC Chile, which is Provast the Secretariat. A users association is also being invited, but they are not organized yet. The council may be extended by the incorporation of new members if they want to apply. Topics in the current agenda include online dispute resolution policy, WHOIS, and IPv6. Conclusions: is it possible to run a CCTLD inside the university? Yes, but it's a lot of work, especially when University of Chile is a kind of public entity, and we have a lot of controls, like over many of the governmental entities in Chile. It is possible to be in connection with the local internet community, and we often made seminars and conferences to share this information or technical issues with the community. We are frequently working with the government, providing advice on matters such as regulations about incarnations of ISPs. And it is possible to develop initiatives from the registry to the community, like, for example, IPv6 transition. And that's it. Thank you.
How many people are working for NIC Chile?
34 people.
Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. I would like now give the floor to the audience. Questions, comments? Yes, please.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Matthias Treimer. I'm here as a delegate from the Council of Europe. The Council of Europe's agenda and ICT agenda, you might have seen at various workshops here that it is, of course, closely linked to the enforcement of human rights, and that's the reason why in the Council of Europe, and especially also in a recent recommendation of the Committee of Ministers from November 2007, it's called the Public Service Value of the Internet Recommendation, we had a look of different developments. And there was also asked a question, a workshop yesterday, why we did not definitely or especially refer to the question of domain names in this recommendation. And there was a discussion if that what your services that you just presented to us have a so-called public service value, what I would in principle of course say yes. The question is, and to make it clear, the recommendation endorses very much exactly the models that you have presented, that private companies provide the public with this public service value without any interference of the state. Nonetheless, there is also the Council of Europe's perspective that if the state delegates public services to private companies, finally there should be some accountability of the state if there is a conflict with human rights, like, for example, freedom of expression. So how would you see the role then of the state if, for example, there's a problem when with a registration, somebody wants a domain name for whatever reason.
Could you keep it a bit short?
Yeah, for whatever reason, he does not succeed in getting this domain name. How would you say then the responsibility of the registrar? Thank you.
Thank you. From what I understand, you ask specifically about the role of accountability, how that is sort of managed on
yes.
the... Who would like to pick this question up?
I could say a few words, but I'm probably the worst person to answer this question because we have this accountability framework with the European Commission that is supervising us. I think the interesting part is for those who said that they have little or interaction with the state, that how they work with your question or how they answer your question.
What about GPRS?
Yes, I think the about the relationship with the government, we do an annual report to JPNIC, and they are a kind of doing assessment on our activity continuously whole year. So I think it's the a kind of mechanism for the accountability. Maybe I misunderstood your question, but when there's a kind of activities or problems on which may maybe against the human rights or something, as a registry or a registrar of the domain name, we are not. We think that we are not responsible for how the domain names are used or how what the domain name string means. It's not our matter. So the police or the court order may move us when such things happen.
Okay, thank you. Austria also wants to reply. Please keep it short. There are more questions to come so that we have a more lively discussion.
Just a few words to the question of Matthias Dreimer from the Council of Europe. Well, we've got a legal framework for almost everything. So if there is a case of domain grabbing or if there is a case of infringing with human rights, and we had a case which was quite politically sensitive, there is the ordinary legal framework. There are the judges, there are the courts who proceed, and then NIC-AT, well, it's not exempt from the law. Then NIC-AT has to respect what everything is based on the legal framework. So far, we didn't have any problem with the private management of the registry on the one hand and the legal framework in Austria, on the other hand. It worked so far perfectly well.
Okay, now we have a question from .nl.
Yeah, Rolf Meijer from .nl. I have a question for Hero. Hero, it's not that often that a CCTLD registry is a fully... I hear myself, but... Is it better like this? Okay. It's not that often that a CCTLD registry is a for-profit organization. And I missed some of the structure, the oversight structure between JPRS and JPNIC. But my first question would be, how do you set your prices? And what happens to the surplus?
Yeah, thank you. The policy, including the price, is set by us, the JPRS. We don't consult with the JPNIC or the government. But the market will decide
whether a price is appropriate or not.
Really?
I mean, there's not so much competition. And what do you do with the surplus? Do you have shareholders or?
We have shareholders. And our shareholders are very special because we negotiate them. They don't want to have money. Earn money, so they do want to have.
They only want to have a share.
Yes, it's not.
Sounds like a miracle to me.
Our stocks is not open to the market, and that the shareholders think the know the concept of the internet, how the internet infrastructure is vital to the society, so they don't want to earn money.
Can I ask again? My understanding is you do a monopoly service, right? How can the market then sort of have any impact on the price-setting mechanism? Is it that people run away to other registries if the prices are too high, or how does the market work?
I don't think we are. We do a monopoly because we compete with very many TLDs, so market will decide.
Okay. Next is Martin Boyle.
Private sector will go to the government.
Thank you, Roloff. And of course, I recognize the magnanimity of the private sector coming to the public. Martin Boyle from the UK government. I've got a question specifically aimed at Austria, because I think the UK government approach to the registry and the Austrian government approach to their registry is actually very, very similar. And I'd like actually then to link that to supplement Christian's response to the Council of Europe. Within the UK, there is no formal relationship and, in fact, no formal recognition by the United Kingdom government of Nominet as the .uk registry. It just happens. There was one specific amendment that was made, and again, very similar, it sounds to me, to the Austrian case, that we removed the domain name system from the Communications Act, which was about the numbering, and therefore we were treating it as separate to telephony. My question to Christian is whether in Austria there is some formal recognition by the government of the registry, and if so, why you decided that that was necessary, and if not, why you decided that that was not necessary. So I'm not going to let you off the hook. And then the second part of my intervention was directly associated with the accountability of a private organisation, and I think Christian's answer is exactly right. We have a legal structure, and that has to be responded to. But I think within the UK we have got an accountability to the stakeholders as well, where within the UK system the stakeholders are actually directly involved in that process, and that the framework that is put in place includes then dispute resolution procedures, which one would hope would kick in before we got to a state where somebody was having to take actual law, actual legal response. And therefore, perhaps a question back to the Council of Europe is why they would think it would be necessary for governments to take a more active control and role over the infrastructure to achieve something that actually works offline quite well. Thank you.
Yeah, well, the answer, is there a recognition and what's the reason for the situation? Well, it's quite simple. No, there is no formal recognition, and the answer is it was not necessary.
Emily, do you want to? Okay, then there was another question there at the back. Canada.
I'm feeling like an alien, but I will try to put the country code top level domains in the context of countries, right? Because I imagine that one day in future there is we will have to be a correspondence between the reality and the virtuality, and that's the function of the domains. So the question to the table is exactly that: what would be the vision of you that you are operating this reality of country code top level domains to the next 100 years of internet, right? I don't know if I make clear my question. The future vision of the correspondence between countries, reality of the countries, the mix between public and private domains, the sphere of public domains, the sphere of, like you have in the law, for example, in the law, a century, a millennial knowledge of humanity, we have the private and the public domain, right? So in terms of technology, how the country code top level domain will correspond to a more balanced equivalence between the reality, the real country, and the virtual country that is represented by the country code top level domain right now.
Is that clear?
My question?
Would you like to address it to somebody specifically?
No, to anyone who wants or that have thinking about that point.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not sure if I understand it really correct, but I'll try to answer. I think the local TLD is an anchor in the worldwide internet structure, and I think the business, the registry business and the internet business is more and more, let's say, a normal business in our what we do. In the past, we had a, let's say, a lot of gray zone in the legal situation. And I think also in the technician space, it's more and more clear, and every registry works professionally around the world. So, regarding your question, what is the interaction between virtual and real world? I think the business based on internet or on domain names becomes more and more important for the country, for the country code, and for the internet in that specific countries.
Thank you.
Not sure if that answers your question.
Now .ca.
Thank you. My name's Heather Dryden. I'm with the Canadian Department of Industry. I'm not with .ca, so let me be very clear. My question is really to those that have membership-based organizations or members in some sense of that meaning. CIRA, for example, has members and also is accountable to the general internet community. It's declared a public resource, the .ca. So Is there a way you differentiate between sort of the registrants and someone that you describe as a member? Are they getting something extra? Is there a particular benefit to that?
Are you asking all of them, or would you?
Those that have membership-based organizations or that would have something to comment on.
If we could be seen as memberships, and in fact, URIT was created by five registries, which in your terminology could be the members of the organization, as it is a non-profit organization. They are themselves registries for their own countries, and there is no any benefit or whatsoever. They just, I think, as a board, they more advise the management of the company just to with their expertise in running TLDs. But for registering domain names or whatsoever, there is no benefit at all.
Hiro, do you also want to comment on this one? Mm-hmm. There is another question in the back.
I'm Al Alegre from the Philippines. .ph, which is a bit controversial over the past 5 years. My question is to anyone. In the Philippines, there is one registrar performs both registry and registrar functions. So I don't know if many in the Philippines believe that there are conflict of interest questions involved. I'm not sure if within the CCTLD community there is a view that there are instances where it is best practice to have the marriage between the registry function, keeping the root zone files, etc., and registering, because it is de facto monopoly. There are sort of sub-registrants, but they cannot go beyond a certain price. Is there in the practice instances where this type of arrangement is good? And the second question, since we are in the IGF and it's a governance, I'm wondering, I'm not too familiar with the community of CCTLD administrators. And I just want to know, because given that that's the situation in the Philippines and there might be similar, what are the internal governance sort of mechanisms to sort of do some self-regulation about registrars or registries that have problems, or is that sort of like off limits to others, because that's your own backyard, we will not. Mm-hmm. Are there any instances where other registries or the community mm-hmm. will say that, hey, this is not best practice, this is actually there are very serious public interest questions involved.
So do I understand this correctly? The second question refers to potential drawbacks of self-regulatory mechanisms?
No, just to see if within the current governance or self-governing sort of group of administrators within the ICANN structure, is what are the mechanisms if a member has serious public interest sort of debates happening, do co-members have the opportunity or the inclination to sort of perform community co-regulatory functions to tell the erring registry that there are problems with how it's running in particular countries?
Maybe I'm not sure that I fully understood your question, but if one member or organization would be dominant in the regulatory process, I would doubt that self-regulatory is the right word to use then, and probably then there is something wrong with the model. I think in most cases that I know of, self-regulatory is working well because there are no dominant positions that define their agenda.
Maybe I wasn't clear. It's, for example, there's a group of all the registries are grouped together in an association, right? And if the majority feel that there is a problem with how one is being run, are there mechanisms within that organization to sort of take that erring organization to question it, or mm-hmm. just an inquiry or an investigation?
I think, I hope I catch it. There are regional organizations all over the world for example, center in Europe and a little bit broader there in South America and in Asia Pacific area. And this regional organization normally discuss problems, set up best practice papers, position papers, and educate and exchange information under registries. That means that we have success stories or we discuss problems and everything, what is our normal business. So yes, there is an education and information exchange between registries just to educate them and inform them.
But you see the governance problem here, because it's like, for example, I'm a member of the ASEAN, Philippines,
yeah?
And we have a member, Burma, yeah?
What is a member in your
like in the for example, it's like the parallel of an intergovernmental agency like ASEAN.
Okay.
And then there is an erring member, but there's a policy of non-intervention, so nobody can really say that even though there's something happening in that country.
Afraid you have to take this question offline and discuss it, because we've really reached now the end of our time and I see people leaving. So I don't want to be impolite, but I think we need to conclude now. I really like this discussion. There are lots of questions we couldn't really address. For example, further changes people foresee with regard to their registries. But what we probably could show quite well is that there are different models to be successful in this area. So I thank you very much for attending this session. I also want to thank our panelists, and I wish you a nice day and a good way home. Thank you very much.